Well, today we're going to do the Eighth Commandment on the Thou Shall Not Steal. And one of the world's most respected New Testament scholars is the Anglican Bishop N.T. Wright of Durham, England. And in an interview last year with the Catholic Reporter, he expounded on what he felt was the greatest moral issue facing the modern church. And in his opinion, abortion and sexual immorality rank very high, but they were not the most pressing need. In his view, the most deplorable evil the church must address is the unspeakable debt owed by developing countries that keeps escalating with compound interest and no bankruptcy system in place that allows them to draw a line and start over. So as a former student of economics, I suspect that the ever-widening gap between the rich and the poor is a major cause behind much of the world's turmoil and terror. Even the violence that appears to be instigated by age-old religious hatred and strife, like in Ireland and Palestine, is more often than not economic exploitation under the guise of religion. And I think we're naive to think that any economic system is free of the influence of sin and demonic influences. As one person once said, under communism, man oppresses man. Under capitalism, it's just the reverse. So, today we'll examine the Eighth Commandment, and the importance of it cannot be overemphasized because money is perhaps the number one idol that touches all of us to the core. So how does God want his new covenant people to, who are now free to work, who are not enslaved, they're free to make a decent living, how are they to protect their neighbor's possessions and the rights of the poor? So the commandment, do not steal, maintains that every individual has a right to his personal property and that God's covenant people have the responsibility to preserve and protect that right. So just as God has a zeal for his property, what belongs to him, because we're made in his image, it's right that we should feel a zeal for what rightfully belongs to us. And when someone plunders your goods, we feel a sense of outrage, for it is a violation that is beyond the material. The things we have legitimately worked for and own are, in fact, an extension of our personhood. And therefore, for someone to seize them as their own cuts you right to the core. Now, the true value of things really cannot be measured solely in terms of money. For what gives possessions real value are intangible things such as time, effort, relationships, and most of all, memory. So if I were to give you a tour of my home, I love my home. We've been there for 30 years, and it's laden with memory. And the most valuable possessions that Emily and I own are not ones that are the most expensive. They are ones that reflect decades of family memories or connections with previous generations, which are quite rare. Or faraway places that in moments of time became secret havens of holy moments. Or gifts that express the love of lifelong friends. It's those things Emily and I consider precious and irreplaceable. Now, as believers, then, we're to treat all possessions as sacred property with someone's personal name engraved on it. And this makes theft a breach of covenant relationship. Now, in our world of mass production and seemingly endless supplies, it's difficult to visualize a real person behind the development and manufacture of most of the products we consume. The sheer quantities of things make the creators appear anonymous, and the ease by which we can acquire things today in the modern world makes it seem as if things are ours for the taking. And yet, whenever we make illegal copies of computer software or download music with no regard to copyright laws, the breach of relationship is just as real. Somebody paid for what we enjoy. Nothing's free. In fact, if you ever get something for free, you don't value it. And this ought to make us think twice about how we make our purchases. A couple of weeks ago, Emily and I went to a local store, a retailer, to discuss about a new electronics gadget, of which I know nothing about. And we talked to this person about their expertise, and they actually helped us make some decisions doing things differently. And then I went home, and I was kind of tempted, well, heck, I can get this on the Internet a lot cheaper. And I thought about it, and I thought, if I do that, have I removed the relationship value out of the product and have actually stolen this person's time and expertise? I mean, there's a reason things are more expensive in the retail stores. There's a relationship involved. Frugality is a virtue, but getting the best deal is not the guiding force of biblical economics. So let's look then at the kind of stealing the Bible is referring to. And the first is undercover theft. So the verb to steal in the Bible carries with it a sense of duplicity and secrecy, as opposed to stealing by force, as when Rachel stole the household idols belonging to her father, Laban, and hid them. Deceit is often the handmaid to theft. So doing things undercover is an attempt to make the crime go unnoticed and to create enough distance between you and the victim that the painful consequences aren't felt by the perpetrator. And if your deceit is good enough, you can even deceive yourself that no one's hurt. It's often the case in white-collar crime. But for the victims, the pain is just as real as if they were mugged on the street. So just ask the shareholders of Enron, whose executives cut self-enriching deals by manipulating California's deregulated power market, and the California consumer whose energy bills quadrupled in 2001. So in 1999, the electrical costs for the state were $7 billion. In 2000, there were $27 billion. And most of that money ended up in the coffers of Enron and other Texas electrical companies. But perhaps I think the most prevalent deceit and the widespread thievery that goes unchallenged in our culture is the personal theft we blindly execute on ourselves since the advent of what is known as the credit card. Banks and credit card companies have mastered the game of luring customers under the guise of instant buying power and then enslaving the consumer with a personal debt at exorbitant rates of as much as 18%. And when my wife was working at a bank, she was asked to push credit cards in people in the teller lines, and she refused to do it. She felt it was immoral. Today, the average consumer carries 8 credit cards. 20% of the cards are maxed out. The personal credit card debt carried by the average American is $8,560. The interest alone last year was $50 billion. Now, our job as believers is to expose the devious lies that lure people into addictions of debt and bankruptcy, whether it's credit cards or that stupid lottery. I have no opinion, mind you. I mean, just think how stupid it is. People give away their hard-earned money, and you give it to somebody in such an amount, it ruins their life, and everybody's ruined. And the schools get a tip. Anyway, I won't go there. So whether it's credit cards or the lottery or all forms of gambling, you know, online gambling now is taking the toll of college students right down the tubes because of the indebtedness. And even for the fortunate few who once in a blue moon might win at these devious forms of money making, the earnings do not reflect honest work. If you're holding earnings in your hand, if it does not reflect labor, love, relationship, and memory, it has no value. And that's why an inheritance easily gained is quickly lost. You can't keep it. So the proverb says, if you want enduring wealth, you got to work. And you got to have wisdom. Because riches and honor are with me, enduring wealth and righteousness, says the proverb. Now, I am very thankful in my early life I was given sound financial teaching. We had one of our former pastors, some of you may remember him, the Right Reverend Paul Winslow, who was 6'8 or something. He looked down at you and you just did what he said. But he hammered into us young guys that the financial rule of responsibility is you never go into debt except for an appreciating item, like a home. Because it's foolish to think, if you don't have the discipline to save for something in the past, all of a sudden now you can buy it on credit in the false hope that you're going to have greater discipline in the future, not only to save for the principal, but at the principal plus interest. And so you go from no discipline to extreme discipline overnight. And then when the monthly bill arrives on your doorstep and you're confronted with the hard truth of what that monthly commitment actually is, there is another enticement to postpone reality. It's this little box called minimum payment. It's all that's really due, $10. So we give into the temptation to delay the inevitable and we use our funds for our more immediate needs. Now, in harsher terms, I'll just tell you straight up, that's stealing. It's stealing to take money you've already promised for goods and services and to spend it on something else, or to delay payment of a debt when it's in your power to pay it. You know, even in our culture, we're given 30 days bills free. But in the Old Testament, you weren't allowed to hold wages overnight to someone who did services for you. If they gave services for you, you owed them that day. So when Emily and I began to use credit cards, we disciplined ourselves to subtract the amount that we spent from our checkbook like we had just written a check. So when the bill came at the end of the month, we never had to pay interest. And yet, sadly, few are able to discipline themselves from the lure of instant purchasing power. And it's not long before they're skating down that slippery slope of the black hole of debt. So here's your Christmas wish. If you're in debt, own up to it. Own up to all the unwise choices you made. Do everything in your power to get out of debt. Pay what you owe before making any new commitments. You might even try going hungry. Any new commitments, including gifts to the church. Should have had this message before the offering. Now, our elders maintain this principle with strict discipline. If there's not enough funds in the offering to cover our monthly expenses, here's the policy. We first pay all our outstanding debts to the world that we owe. This is money we've already spent. It's not ours to give to another holy purpose or another person. Once those bills are discharged, then we pay the employees, the secretaries, the maintenance people, the people that live on salary. Then if there's anything left over, we divide it among the pastoral staff because they've chosen to live by faith. And in the elders' point of view, if we take money that was already spent on services and use it to pay a pastor's salary, that's stealing and is deplorable witness to the world. So if you placed yourself in debt, you've stolen your future and your freedom. And it would be wonderful if a year from now, this whole congregation was debt-free. As Christians, the only thing we're to owe, as Romans says, owe nothing to anyone except love one another. That's our debt we can't pay back. Keep loving. Now, this term steal was also used for another kind of theft. It was used also for kidnapping of individuals, the most heinous form of robbery. Joseph uses this term to explain his plight to Pharaoh's cupbearer of why he was in prison. He says, "I was in fact kidnapped or stolen from the land of the Hebrews. And even here, I've done nothing that they should put me in this dungeon." So think about Joseph, our great forefather in the faith. He was robbed of his family, robbed of his country, robbed of his livelihood. In short, everything that makes a person human was stolen from him. And that victimization was branded into the psyche of Israel as the pharaohs freely plundered entire populations of human beings, along with foreign and domestic natural resources. And they all to enhance the stockpiles of their own private wealth. And then the foolishness, they stuck it all in the grave. Now, what's amazing to me is that when people have the ability to control all the means of production or they have access to all natural resources, that works like a drug to daze those in power with pride that borders on the demonic. It creates an insatiable appetite to consume until luxury and opulence becomes a private right, a divine right, at the expense of all human rights. And in the end, it removes all compassion from the poor. And that's the environment God wanted his people to live in for four centuries. It was such a tyranny. It was so severe. There was nothing Israel could claim as their own, even their own children. And though Pharaoh thought he was sovereign and he could do as he pleased, immune from threat, his economic system came under severe scrutiny by the Almighty God. And when somebody says, "This is mine, I have made it, and I can do what I want," God's wrath is provoked. Christopher Wright notes that while the freedom that God achieved in the Exodus was comprehensive, Israel was freed politically, spiritually, socially, economically, it was the cry of the poor out of their oppression that pushed God over the edge and spurred him into action. The fundamental truth that was to govern Israel's attitude about economics was not found in Keynesian or Friedman or free market economics. It was found in the doctrine of creation. God says the earth is the Lord's and all it contains, the world and all who dwell in it. So this may sound a little radical to us, but in Israel's theology, privatized ownership was not an absolute right. You really don't own what you own. Ultimately, God owns all things. We hold them in trust. And God holds us accountable to him for others who might have a greater need than us, for how we administer and distribute our wealth. And just as God demolished the infrastructure of Egypt with a wrecking ball because of their economics, Israel could be sure that God would keep an eagle eye watch and scrutiny over her economy. So whenever Israel's prophets spoke of God's impending judgment on his people, it was always because her idolatry had generated an insatiable greed that led to the trampling of the rights of the poor. And in the end, both Israel and Judah's economic systems were completely dismantled for her persistent and flagrant violation of the rights of the poor in the Eighth Amendment. In 1989, a team of us made our second trip into Romania during communism. And as you probably know the history, Ceausescu exported the entire food supply to pay the national debt, starving his people, while he built a palace bigger than Versailles for himself. So after several of us toured down Bucharest, we came to this palace, and it was nearing completion. And in front of the palace were two parallel lines of stone buildings. It's laid out like Washington, D.C., on beautiful stone buildings for all the royalty and so on. At the end of that display of opulence was a small butcher shop. And outside was a line of hungry buyers stretching as far as you could see. And in the butcher shop, you didn't have a choice to what you were going to buy, whether it was the whatever. You just took where the butcher was cutting. If it was the head of the chicken, you got the head. It was the thigh, you got the thigh. And you just worked your way through the line. So my friend, Dr. Arthur Halliday, stood in front of the palace and he opened up to Amos 5 and he paraphrased this word. Though you build your houses of well-hewn stone, you will not live at them because you turn the poor aside at the gate. I didn't know it then that Arthur was a prophet. But Ceausescu was killed December 25th of that year. He never occupied his palace. The Eighth Commandment was vindicated once again. Now, God knows that with sin in the human race, greed is present, and you can't depend just on free market goodwill to protect people. So he had laws to protect the poor. So in Israel's laws, you were not permitted to profit from somebody else's misfortune. So that's why Israel had a ban on interest. Now, this was not interest for commercial reasons like we do interest. It was interest for someone in need who needed money because of a disaster, like all our friends in Mississippi. So when people suffer legitimate misfortune, those who have a surplus ought to share in the burdens of others rather than getting rich at their expense. In fact, when Ken and Gary were in Mississippi, they were saying, because FEMA's throwing a lot of money at this thing, if somebody will come in and put a tarp over your house, they're giving $2,000. So all the roofers were coming in like vultures to make money on a disaster. If you had no land in Israel, if you were an alien or a widow or a foreigner, you were allowed to freely go through the fields. And if you had a crop, you weren't allowed to harvest the crop fully. You're to leave things there for the poor. And at the times of the festival, the poor and the foreigners and the orphans are allowed to eat at the banquet to the heart's consent freely. It was built into the system. And debts that arose from misfortune also had limits. Once every 50 years in the year of Jubilee, individuals who had become enslaved due to debt were set free and restored to their land. Land in Israel was sacred. It wasn't for grabs. You always restored the person back to their land. And Israel's laws also prohibited the accumulation of large amounts of wealth into the hands of a few individuals. So when Israel distributed the land, it was not only distributed among tribes, but families. And given the variety of Palestinian geography, this didn't mean that everyone should have the same, but that every family should have enough to be economically viable. Even the king was not allowed to stockpile reserves for himself to give his life prestige. So in the ancient Near East, if you were a king, the way you got prestige was the three W's: weapons, women, and wealth. A king in Israel is to look like an ordinary brother. He can't use his office to get rich. Now, nobody obeyed it, but that's the law. And I think this gives good advice to Christian executives and Christian political leaders. They ought to consider this when they attempt to construct pay scales. I mean, is it right that there should be a tiny elite who live in the luxury of two or three vacation homes while the mass of common workers barely make their monthly commitments? Or compare the obscene salaries that are doled out in the name of sport or entertainment with those who labor in the trenches to shape and to save lives like teachers and nurses. The inequality is immoral. Oh, you teachers can applaud here. Even in most churches, a senior pastor's salary is usually exorbitantly more than his associates. And I'm happy to say at PBC there's a very narrow range in the salaries of the pastoral staff, because salary is not merely based on experience and responsibility, but also on need. And when our founder, Ray Stedman, ministered among us, there was times when he was not the highest paid staff member, because the needs of others were greater. And he's the one that encouraged the institution of that principle. So given the seriousness with which Israel is to protect her neighbor's possessions, what were the penalties for theft? Well, as you probably know, in ancient cultures, because the kings made the laws and they didn't want anyone touching their wealth, if you touched their wealth, you died. So penalties for stealing were very severe, because they wanted to protect their massive fortunes. Israel's laws also made stealing a risky occupation, as citizens were given the right to sic their dogs on any intruders, and if a thief was caught breaking in and he was struck so that he died, no guilt was incurred. So you could shoot a thief. So if a person wants to break the sanctity of your home, you had the right to defend yourself. Now, in contrast to other cultures, however, the penalty for a convicted thief was far more humane and proportionate to the crime, and served as a constant reminder that relationships were the primary concern in all economic transactions. So if I stole your sheep, I not only had to restore you one sheep, I had to pay you two sheep, so that I would feel the full measure of my crime against you. Now, if I took your sheep and went to Costco and sold it and got a lot of money, I had to give you four sheep or five sheep, because I tried to get rich at your expense. If I couldn't make full restitution, I had to sell everything I owned and give it to you. If that wasn't enough, I had to do your housework for a lot of years and be your slave until the debt was paid off. Now, what you realize is that that system not only enforces absolute justice, it serves to restore broken relationships in a covenant community. A criminal was not sent off to prison to live out his stipulated sentence isolated in a lonely cell away from society. I think our system of incarceration, I mean, you need it for violent criminals, but most of our thieves are white collar. And rather than enforcing their alienation, it'd be far better for them to teach them to reenter society and love the people that they wronged. So if you were a thief in Israel, you had to reenter the relationship, not only pay back dollar for dollar, you had to contribute more to that person, and now you're fulfilling the law when it means you are loving your neighbor as yourself. So why flog a thief when you can transform a thief into a friend, or better yet, a lover? And the New Testament maintains the same spirit in economic relationships. Paul writes to the Ephesians that believers should forsake their old ways of stealing. But don't just put off the old way. Work with your hands. Make more money than you need so that you can learn to contribute to the life and to love others. So the real answer to the sin of slavery or thievery is the virtue of love. Contributing to others. Now, when you come to the New Testament, as you might expect, Jesus makes this commandment radical, as he does all the commandments. And though the exile had removed external forms of idolatry from Israel, the temptation to get rich at the expense of the poor still remained a strong force within the nation. The lure of wealth spread like leaven among the ruling class and eventually corrupted the entire priesthood and the whole court of the Sadducees that sold off political compromise with Rome to get their wealthy homes in Jerusalem. And the divide between rich and poor in the first century was gigantic. And you can see this in Mark's gospel in one scene when Mark compares a wealthy scribe with a worshiping widow in Mark 12. Jesus is teaching in the temple. He unmasks the hypocrisy of the scribes. One of the things they like to do is kind of link in their prayer shawls in public. You know, like at graduation, we all wear these robes for your degrees. You know, it's one thing to wear the robe at graduation with all the colors. It's another thing to wear it all week long when you go to Safeway. And you go, it's a little arrogant. That's what they loved, wearing their prayer shawls longer and longer. And they always wanted the first place at the seats of the banquets, and made long prayers. But underneath it, these scribes were oppressive and brutal. Because in Old Testament times, teachers of the law were not allowed to receive payment for their services. And that made them dependent on gifts from patrons. So greedy teachers abused the system by preying on the generous hospitality of widows. And once they became ingratiated with the widow, they wouldn't hesitate to devour their entire estate. And to cover up their crimes, they lengthened their prayers. And Jesus is watching such scribes, and he unmasked them. Now, next to the wealthy scribe now comes a widow. And she comes to the treasury as the rich people are throwing in their funds. And the spectacle, what they had in the outside of the court of the women was this trumpet-shaped 13 trumpets receptacle. And you threw your money in it. And the wealthy, when they came with their large sums, when they threw their money in there, you could hear the sounds. It would resound like a pinball machine at an arcade, or like a jackpot in a Las Vegas casino. You know, they had everything but the lights. And so the rich bring in all their money, and then comes the widow. And what she puts in are two small copper coins, fits in the small of your hand, called a lepta. And the two together are worth about an eighth of a cent. And Jesus calls the disciples over. He asked the question, why was she poor? Probably because the scribes had devoured her wealth. And notice that she comes to the temple not seeking justice. She comes to worship. She has two coins. She could keep one. She doesn't give one. She gives them both. And Jesus says, she gave more than all the rich. Why? Because her two coins symbolize her love and devotion to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It was her whole life she put in there. And it's a symbol of her trust. And so here again, we are instructed that the true value of possessions is not measured in terms of money, but in relational terms of love and devotion. So the rich gave out of their surplus, and though it was a loud noise, it was like an inconsequential tip. She gave out of her poverty two weightless coins, symbolic of her complete surrender to God. It's a great insight here. In the kingdom of God, poverty is a gift. Because every act of kindness that a poor person does for you is drenched in love. You ever been loved by a poor person? Why do you think our kids get so changed when they go down to Mexico? Because they're loved by people that have nothing, and every display of love and every act is such measured of love in it, it changes their hearts. And this is why Jesus tells the rich, don't just give your money, be rich in good works, because you need to feel the love. And is this why Jesus became poor? That many could become rich with his love. And perhaps this suggests that what we have the most to give is what we have least of. What we most have to give is what we have least of. So for a wealthy business executive, this doesn't mean don't lavish your wife or children with expensive gifts at Christmas. Rather, consider giving them a complete day of your time. Probably the very thing they've been stolen all year. So the old covenant demands that we need not steal. We should always be watchful to care for the poor. The new covenant asks us to be willing to become poor, to know the true riches of love. Amen.